Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, the Suez Crisis, episode 2.10. Last time we looked at some nitty-gritty details, above all how people in the background in Britain were beginning to see the legal problems behind a potential military strike against Egypt. If Britain acted in this way, the consensus appeared to indicate she would not be on firm legal ground, or on the moral high ground. Yet despite this, and despite the objections and clear policy put down by President Eisenhower, Prime Minister Anthony Eden continued on with his French allies regardless. In this episode, after a somewhat winding tale, we're introduced to the other significant pillar of the Suez Crisis equation, that of Israel, and how it fit in with first the plans of the French, and then, after some prodding, with the plans of the British. Without any further ado then, we've got a lot to cover today, so I'll just get right into it. I'll then take you to an interesting scene as the Australian Prime Minister returned home after a stormy meeting in Cairo. It had been an eventful fortnight for Robert Menzies, the Prime Minister of Australia since 1949. Menzies was a Dominion leader of the old school, with a record of war service and British connections to boot. He was loyal to a fault to the line taken by Britain, and he was adamant that the nationalisation of the Suez Canal represented a grave indication of Nasser's insidious intentions. Anyone who ignored the line put forward by Eden, or who tried to rationalise Gamal Abdel Nasser's nationalisation of the Suez Canal Company as purely academic, ignored, in Menzies' opinion, two salient facts, and these two salient facts, in Menzies' own words, were: first, for historical reasons, the concession had an international character recognized by international convention. It could not, therefore, be regarded as a merely domestic enterprise under the sole control of the Egyptian government. Second, what Egypt did was to repudiate this contractual concession 12 years before its due date, without consultation and without agreement. If such a repudiation is not a breach of international law, then there is no international law. Menzies may have had something of a point here, but the problem was, Eden wasn't just looking to criticise Nasser's moves for the sake of it. He was looking to use them as an excuse for military intervention. This, his lawmakers assured him, would not be possible. In Menzies' case, though, having attended the Canal Users Conference on the 16th of August, 1956, the Australian Prime Minister believed that his work here was done, and he got ready to return to Canberra when he received a strange telephone call, Menzies remembered. At around 2 a.m. in the morning of the 17th of August, the telephone rang and woke me up. On the line was the American ambassador. He said, "I want you to come to my house." "When?" I asked. "Right away," came the reply. "Anthony, Selwyn and Foster are here with some others. They want to discuss a matter with you." I protested and asked whether I would not keep till the morning. He said that it would not, and that he would send a car down to me at once. I got up, dressed, and arrived at the residence at around 2:30 a.m. Menzies was about to discover why he had been woken up. It was going to be up to him to represent the conclusions of the Canal Users Conference to President Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was to be the man tasked with explaining this case to the Egyptian president because, as Eden insisted, Menzies knows how to put a case. Yet, knowing what we know about Anthony Eden's end goal in all of this, it seems that Menzies was chosen less because he knew how to put a case and more because he was a convenient fall guy now that John Foster Dulles was refusing to travel all the way to Cairo. It will be up to Menzies to explain the findings of the Canal Users Conference, which Nasser had refused to attend himself. In short, an internationally constituted body of people would be created to advise the Egyptians on how to operate the canal and its company. This Nasser was unlikely to accept, since he would view it as more foreign interference in Egyptian affairs. At the same time, Menzies could be expected to do his duty, and as a committed Anglophile, Eden anticipated that he would stand firm for British interests when face to face with President Nasser. We should remember that since Eden's aim was to gain American approval for the use of force, he had wanted this Canal Users Conference episode to blow up in Dulles' face. When John Foster Dulles' ideas were publicly rejected in a face-to-face meeting with Nasser, Then, Eden believed, the American Secretary of State would see his point of view and advocate sterner, forceful measures. But because John Foster Dulles refused to go, Menzies was to go in his place. This didn't mean Eden's plans were defeated. On the contrary, Eden believed that since the Canal Users Conference had been Dulles' idea either way, its rejection by Nasser would still force the Americans into sterner action. Menzies, loyal to a fault to London's interests, could be expected to stand up to Nasser's nationalism, which made it even more unlikely that the decisions reached by the Canal Users Conference would be approved of in Cairo. This indeed is what happened. Menzies was totally out of his depth in Cairo, and had attempted to approach Nasser in a spirit, first of casual camaraderie, and then with some barely veiled threats when that didn't work. That Nasser later complained of having to deal with this Australian mule tells its own story. Eden's plan had worked. Menzies claimed that we parted in the most amicable way. But this amicability seems to have persuaded Nasser to break off the talks, accusing Menzies of trying to impose collective colonialism in regulated form. So the amicability can't have gone particularly far. Menzies came to the conclusion that the situation was hopeless, and like many great statesmen, he now looked for someone to blame for the embarrassing way things had gone down. Rather than blame Eden, who had a vested interest in seeing these talks fail, Menzies chose to lambast the Americans. When President Eisenhower gave his weekly press conference in late August, he had insisted that we are committed to a peaceful settlement of this dispute. Nothing else. This line, in Menzies' opinion, cut his legs out from under him, since Nasser knew that, according to the Americans, force would not be forthcoming. He had been less likely to bow to threats, and this gave the final power into the hands of Nasser. If Menzies' logic was flawed, then his idea that maintaining pro-British sentiments would unify his government at home, in Australia, were delusional. Menzies' trip to Cairo, taking place in the first few days of September 1956, is worth recounting because of the important change it indicated in the feeling of the Commonwealth members. For just as Menzies lambasted the Americans, at home in Australia, his foreign minister, who had been the resident minister in Egypt during the Second World War, had come out strongly against military action. This was bad, because it indicated that Menzies' government was fracturing, but of interest to us is the fact that Menzies' foreign minister identified with the policy of Lester Pearson, the Canadian foreign minister, who would soon assume a very important role. What this little episode demonstrated, then, was that not only were his lawmakers and the Americans against what Eden's government was trying to do, but the Commonwealth was also turning away from the policy of using force. Where Eden saw the reclamation of prestige and the need to gain satisfaction, his Australian and Canadian peers saw American and Asian condemnation, the absence of NATO support, and censure by the United Nations. Eden waited eagerly to see what John Foster Dulles would do, now that his Canal Users Conference and its fallout had produced no result, and only made Nasser more suspicious and objectionable. If Eden was hoping to see Dulles abandon all conciliatory policies and fall in line with the Prime Minister's forceful policy, though, then he was especially deluded. Bear in mind that on the 2nd of September 1956, Eden had received that long letter from President Eisenhower that we read out at the end of the last episode. Despite Eisenhower's clearly stated policy and his plain abhorrence of the use of force in Egypt, Eden still seems to have expected that his Secretary of State would approve of a policy which would almost certainly result in war in Egypt, or at least a humiliating climb down and perhaps a regime change in Cairo. If Dulles and Eisenhower would have been horrified at these disruptive aims, then they would have been still more aghast to note that in Eden's cabinet, an Egyptian committee, consisting of several hawkish members of Eden's government, had been established, with one of its aims being the replacement of President Nasser with someone else. As early as 2 days after Nasser had nationalised the Canal Company on the 28th of July, this committee was reasoning that a new Egyptian government could be crafted from a large number of formerly prominent and able figures, who, it was hoped, would come forward immediately once Nasser was toppled. Selwyn Lloyd, the British Foreign Secretary, even then noted, "We might hope to stay in Cairo no more than a day or two." The Egyptian committee acknowledged, somewhat cryptically, that toppling Nasser might be achieved, perhaps, by less elaborate operations than those required to secure physical possession of the canal itself. But, as Great Britain's case before world opinion was based on the need to secure international control over the canal, a diplomatic charade would be necessary, this committee believed, for Eden's government to cover their tracks. Eden and his close circle of cabinet ministers, who were on for a strike against Nasser's Egypt, thus possessed wide-reaching goals, with nothing less than the ruin or removal of Nasser being enough for them. Only through the ruin or removal of Nasser could Britain's interests be secured, and Eden be seen to gain sufficient satisfaction. Eden had intimated this idea before, when the crisis over the nationalisation first kicked off, by insisting that Britain had no quarrel with the Egyptian people, only with Nasser himself, during one of the earliest televised addresses. This claim was of course ludicrous because Nasser was popular at home, and his policies had the enthusiastic approval of the Egyptian people. If Eden wanted to blunder into Cairo and remove Nasser, he would have to march over several dead Egyptian bodies to do it. Only once Nasser was removed would a new regime in Cairo then be forced to agree to the new terms of the Suez Canal. This, it is important to bear in mind, was Eden's end goal. Everything he did, from setting up doomed diplomatic representations, such as that conducted by Robert Menzies, to preparing a military strike in league with France, was aimed at fulfilling this goal. In spite of all the wealth of opposition sent against him, Eden never abandoned the notion that only by defeating Nasser in some fashion could the canal be retaken and British interests secured. Remembering Eden's goal is important because it helps to explain why he approved yet another canal user's solution put forward by Dulles. Once more, Eden believed that the failure of this plan would force the Americans into taking a sterner line with Nasser. In addition, seeing the world still in terms of Victorian Britain, Eden seems to have believed that if Dulles' latest plan was rejected by Nasser, then Dulles would be humiliated and burning for some kind of revenge. In addition, this canal users association, which Dulles was advocating in the second week of September 1956, represented to Eden a chance for Britain in another way. Nasser, Eden believed, was only a temper tantrum away from causing an international incident, and this latest plan, which would see foreign powers guide their own ships through the Suez Canal, was bound to anger him and perhaps provoke him to take retaliatory action. Again, these ideas were ridiculous, because unlike Eden, President Nasser seems to have grasped that he held the moral high ground, and he was not about to jeopardize this position. Similarly, when Dulles' latest idea was inevitably rejected in Cairo, the American Secretary of State just shrugged his shoulders and suggested alternative options. He did not, as Eden expected, take policy defeats so personally. But before Dulles could take his policy defeat like a professional statesman would, Eden took the opportunity on the 11th of September to make a speech before the House of Commons, in which he lumped a great deal more significance on this Canal Users Association than Dulles had wanted. Among other zingers, Eden said, "I must make it clear that should the Egyptian government interfere with the operations of the association or refuse to extend to it the minimum of cooperation, then that government will once more be in breach of the 1888 Convention. I must remind the House that what I am saying is the result of exchanges of views between three governments. In that event, Her Majesty's government and others will be free to take such steps as seem to be required, either through the United Nations or by other means, for the assertion of their rights." In doing this speech, Eden had essentially taken a compromise proposal from Dulles and used it to beat the Egyptians over the head. Dulles hadn't wanted this at all. Now there was no way Nasser would accept it if Eden was going to couch it in language like this. Eden had put words in Dulles' mouth, and by doing so, he had transformed the American policy into one of confrontation when this was the last thing Eisenhower wanted to do with Egypt. Eden had done this, it seemed, all for the sake of a few cheers from his backbenchers in the Commons. Yet he had also done this after several strongly worded and clearly stated memos from Washington affirming the president's view that force would not be used. How many times did Washington need to say this before Eden decided to believe it? Dulles would come to realize that Eden wasn't ignoring America's stated policy because he was ignorant. He was ignoring it because it wasn't what he wanted to hear, and because he wanted to use American support for his own ends. At this stage of the game in mid-September, though, Dulles was both confused and angry, believing, correctly enough, that Eden had acted deliberately in bad faith. Dulles was doubly irritated, even before Eden came out with the speech in the Commons, because he had been informed that Nasser was not going to accept the idea of a canal users association. Just as Dulles had been attempting to pick up the pieces then, Eden had taken this failing policy line, put a confrontational spin on it, and then declared America's unwavering support of it. All of this rubbish Dulles had to deal with after repeatedly telling Eden his government's views and being mindful of the fact that a presidential election was only 2 months away. Dulles simply didn't have time for Eden's nonsense, and when he met with the Washington Press Corps on the 12th of September, he stated publicly, largely for Eden's benefit, that if we cannot work out a program for getting ships through the canal on acceptable terms, the alternative would be to send our vessels around the Cape, before adding, we do not intend to shoot our way through. This public statement seemed to contradict what Eden had just said in the Commons the previous day. The British Prime Minister was thus embarrassed once more, as well as desperate for some new lead. This lead came surprisingly enough from Selwyn Lloyd, Eden's foreign secretary, who was rarely credited with an original idea during the period. It was Selwyn Lloyd's idea to put the matter to the United Nations, a scheme which was first opposed by Eden, and then approved of, in light of Dulles' public disavowal of the use of force for the umpteenth time. This set off alarm bells both in the United States and in Canada. Neither Dulles nor Lester Pearson wanted to see Eden use the United Nations as a cover for military intervention in Egypt. Dulles had the additional fear that the spectacle would divide the Western allies in the UN Security Council, but Eden by no means appeared strong in his acceptance of the United Nations idea. Tory backbenchers now accused him of wasting time once more, having praised him only the day before for committing to a strong policy. Eden knew that he needed to keep pressure on Nasser, so in cooperation with the French, a decision was held whereupon it was decided that the best way to pile pressure on Cairo would be to remove the European experts in the Suez Canal Company. These drivers, or pilots, were required to train for nearly a decade before they could have the honour of guiding the vessels through the canal, and it was the opinion of the former chief executive of the Suez Canal Company, a Frenchman by the name of Jacques-Georges Picot, that without European pilots, the canal traffic would seize up and chaos would ensue. The idea that the Egyptians would be helpless without their European experts on hand to guide them was proven utterly false within 48 hours of the very provocative decision to repatriate the Europeans on the 14th of September. Eden imagined a terrible scene, perhaps even retaliation on Nasser's part, with the exodus of the European experts back home. To his immense chagrin, and to the immense embarrassment of Jacques-Georges Picot, though, the canal didn't seize up, and the Egyptians proved just as able of guiding the ships through the canal as their European counterparts. So, with this failure, it was back to the drawing board once more. Problems existed in the realm of military strategy as well. Operation Musketeer had been the agreed-to military plan for the Anglo-French leadership to follow. This entailed a strike on Alexandria above all, which would be followed by a march southwards towards Cairo, where President Nasser would then be unseated as president, a regime change would follow, and the canal would be retaken. This plan contained several variables, and necessitated close Anglo-French cooperation if the Egyptian Air Force was to be destroyed and the element of coordinated surprise maintained. On the 7th of September, though, discussions about Operation Musketeer had reached something of an impasse. After due consideration, and after having received some important information from their sources in Alexandria, the Anglo-French command was getting cold feet over the plan to attack Alexandria. The casualties would be grave, and success would not be guaranteed if the Egyptians put up sufficient resistance. Deliveries of anti-air and anti-tank guns from their Soviet suppliers seems to have tipped this argument towards considering a new primary objective, and Port Said, the city at the opening of the canal on the Mediterranean side, became the new focus. Operation Musketeer Revise was thus born, but not everyone was happy. The diplomatic searching seemed to be accompanied by military uncertainty. Could the operation really be tackled professionally and safely? Imagine the disaster if Anglo-French forces were repelled or were unsuccessful. The whole point was to present a military fait accompli, and this could hardly be done if the Allies were suffering in the desert, or if Egyptian resistance proved far more fanatical than expected. Even while Eden didn't rate the Egyptians very highly, he did accept that casualties, either of an Allied or local civilian nature, would be unacceptable, and he approved the idea of abandoning the old plan to bombard Alexandria from the sea first. In the second week of September, Anglo-French military and political authorities met, still in the strictest secrecy. The French Prime Minister and his Foreign Minister were in London on the 10th of September, and they agreed with Eden and Selwyn Lloyd that Alexandria was bound to cause casualties in the civilian population, which would have been immensely bad form. The objections of the French military were duly noted. Port Said would not accrue advantage to the Allies, and it would not remove Nasser either. Eden doesn't seem to have grasped this important point, but the French did. Guy Millay and his foreign minister, Christian Pinault, were a great deal more calm and collected in their conversations with Eden and Lloyd than they had been on previous occasions. If Eden didn't know any better, he could have discerned that his French counterparts didn't expect this military operation to even be necessary. Yet Eden refrained from asking the French what it was that had changed, perhaps because he suspected that he knew the answer and that he knew he would not like it. The French, you see, had acquired a new ally, one which, at this stage, Eden wanted absolutely nothing to do with. David Ben-Gurion had a long and detailed shopping list. On his list was 60 Mystier Mark IV, the latest in French fighter jet technology, 36 Vautour, a jet bomber which had yet to roll off the production line, 2,000 tanks, and an enormous stockpile of anti-tank missiles, along with piles of other equipment, small arms, and ammunition. The bill came to around $100 million, but the President of Israel was more than willing to pay. Thanks to a mutual understanding Ben-Gurion had with the French Minister of Defense, a Franco-Israeli relationship seemed destined to blossom. It was all about mutual interests. Neither Israel nor France was particularly fond of Britain's Baghdad Pact, forged in previous years. Both were in search of allies in one another's home region, and both were occupied by conflicts. Algeria in the French case, the looming war with Egypt in Israel's, which both required some arms deals and cash in order to fight. The Franco-Israeli relationship developed out of arms deals into a more important diplomatic and strategic partnership, so that, by summer 1956, Paris and Tel Aviv were sharing intelligence and nuclear assets, not to mention another arms deal worth $80 million, which aimed at solving the siege mentality present in Israel's government. Yet, as ever, the relationship was not so simple as a conspiracy launched against Egypt. While Israel's ambassador in France had voiced her approval of a war with Egypt and indicated that Israel would support the French during any confrontation with President Nasser, President Ben-Gurion knew that, like Eden in London, he couldn't afford to be seen as the aggressor. It would be necessary for Egypt to give some kind of provocation for Israel to justify this action first. At the same time, Ben-Gurion knew that Israel desperately needed allies in the region, and he couldn't afford to look a French gift horse in the mouth if the opportunity for a swift strike against Nasser presented itself. In the meetings held in late August, the French suggested that Israel conquer the Sinai Peninsula and thereafter turn the Suez Canal into an Israeli-owned waterway. This indicated just how far the French were willing to go to take Nasser down, after he had caused them so many problems in Algeria. The nationalization of the canal had sharpened all attitudes, and Nasser was evidently becoming more active in his quest to stand for pan-Arabism against the surrounded Israel. On the 19th of September then, the culmination of the canal users' conference, which Eden had earlier attempted to make political credit out of, before the Commons, opened in London. Throughout this conference, Anglo-French solidarity was the order of the day, and Dulles gave the impression that he was willing to support this bloc, diplomatically at least, in their quarrel with Egypt. As was the general trend during the period, Dulles was caught between not wanting to urge the Anglo-French to make war by encouraging them too much, and not wanting to push the Anglo-French bloc away by refusing to cooperate in the Egyptian scheme. It required a careful policy of balance, and Selwyn Lloyd, who represented the British at this iteration of an effort to find a solution to the Suez spat, recorded that Dulles was on flying form. In public, Dulles seemed adept at encouraging the Anglo-French, without pushing them into making war. In private, though, Dulles was deeply vexed by the unfolding situation. He cabled Eisenhower that day, on the 19th of September, to the effect that, "My general impression is that the British and French have quite isolated themselves, even from what are naturally their closest friends. The Norwegians, whom the British habitually count upon, are worried, and also Italy, which, since the war has worked closely with France, is also worried. The fact is that the United States is the only bridge between the British and the French and the rest of the countries here. I do not yet know whether that bridge is going to hold. The Egyptians are making an enormous effort to make it appear that the Canal Users Association is a device to lead the member down the path to war, for which the British and French are preparing, and Egyptian propaganda in this sense is having a definite impact. Doubt that we shall make as much or as rapid progress this week as the British and French have wanted, but we will know better by tomorrow." Dulles' optimism that more would be known and that issues would be solved in the future were not to pan out. American intelligence at this stage centered on the notion that while Britain and France were convinced that the elimination of Nasser is essential to the preservation of vital Western interests in the Middle East and North Africa, military action is likely only in the event of some new and violent provocation. This was incorrect, though. There was a big difference between carrying on until a provocation emerged, and then scrambling to react to it, and what the French were actually doing in preparing for a military operation against Egypt and trying desperately to find some justification for launching this operation thereafter. The Anglo-French did not yet have the justification, but they had been preparing for over a month by the time Dulles sent this cable home to Washington to find one, and in light of these extensive preparations, it was next to impossible that they would not eventually find some way to bring these preparations to bear. Dulles had been somewhat misled by what he interpreted as a softening French attitude. This, Dulles interpreted in the French support of the UN approach, which he believed demonstrated that Paris wasn't finished talking about things rationally. If Dulles believed that the French hadn't abandoned the diplomatic solution, though, then this was because the French were putting up a front. In public, approving of the British representations to the United Nations, and in private, the French government was engaged in significant talks with the Israelis, to the extent that Eden began to worry that his French ally was drifting away from him. Perhaps the French were getting cold feet, the Prime Minister worried. He and Selwyn Lloyd even travelled to Paris on the 26th of September with the intention of making clear to the French their strong commitment to the new Entente and to getting rid of Nasser. The French Premier reciprocated by sharing some extent of the Franco-Israeli plans, but not their full extent. The French cooperated with Eden, but refrained from sharing all that they had been up to. It was now apparent to those French generals who had objected to the Port Said being made the new target, rather than Alexandria, that if the Israelis attacked over Sinai, then the French would be able to capture the Egyptians in a pincer, and perhaps would not even have to deploy troops at all if their air force could do more of the work from above, and the Israelis attack on the ground. The day after the British delegation returned to London, on the 28th of September, the Israelis arrived in France, and out of these discussions came one unavoidable conclusion. France did not have the air power to utterly destroy the Egyptian air force in the manner that the Israeli plans required. The British would have to be brought on side. The question of how to achieve this delicate task, especially since the high-level Anglo-French talks were ongoing to modify Operation Musketeer, was a conundrum which we will investigate in the next episode. Until next time, my lovely history friends and patrons, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956 episode 2.10. Thanks for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.